the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome back to another episode of the CBP here on the media network of the same name. So easy to remember. My name is Joey, doing a solo rip tonight with our buddy Luke Broyles. But before we get started, as always, two great sponsors over here at the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. One, EasyDNS, Mark and team, best place around if you want to host some content there, become unassailable is the title of Mark's book, will remind you. Great place to do private, virtual private servers. Man, I got to get that right. Virtual private servers. So if you do BTC Pay Server, want to run a Nostr Relay, stuff like that, he can help you with that. You can do email there, website and domain hosting, as I mentioned before. They'll help you migrate all your stuff. So if you have your product suite with someone else at the moment, you can bring all your stuff over there. Mark and team will help you. As always, you know, if you use our code CBP Media or tell Mark that we sent you, you get a nice discount. I think it's 50% off your initial buy. And Mark has been a friend of the show for a long time, co-host once or twice as well. I'm sure he's not done with that duty yet. So Mark, if you're listening, don't relax just yet, my man. So yeah, head over to the EasyDNS and give them a shout and let them know that we sent you. They'll hook you up with a decent deal. And then Bull Bitcoin, our latest sponsor, best place for you to buy KYC free Bitcoin. After all the stuff today about Swan and Prime and Fortress, non-custodial, we think it's the way. That's what we use. We've been moving in this direction for a long time since we started the show, as all you guys know. And we're happy that they're a sponsor. You can pay your bills with Bull. You can do DCA. You can do weekly buys. You can do all manner of different things over there. And of course, they also have the privacy stuff baked in. So CoinJoin with every transaction, you can't beat that. Francis, obviously, you know, legendary in the space. We're glad to be affiliated with him and the team. Those guys are fantastic. We had the pleasure of meeting them at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference. So with that said, another guy I had the pleasure of meeting and introducing at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference, Luke Broyles. Luke, how are you, buddy? What's going on?
I'm doing well. And funny enough, I'm wearing one of your sponsors' shirts. See, this is what happens when people send me shirts. I wear them. That's great. Dude, so yeah, they're awesome.
It's a great shirt.
To meet you and all the guys.
They're a great company. Yeah. And man, that conference was awesome. It was good meeting you. You did a great presentation Sunday morning, and I want to get into a little bit about that. But first, Luke, you know what? I think maybe we should start with the basics here. Who are you? What's your background like? How did you come into the Bitcoin picture here?
Yeah, I get asked that almost every time, and I hope people don't get tired of my answer because it's really not that different, that interesting. But I did a lot of things when I was younger. I had many hobbies, many interests, pursued them all. Filmmaking was the one that captured my attention the most. I did that for many years. Lots of feature films, short films, documentaries, narratives. Did the film festival circuit for multiple years. Had a blast. This would be middle school, high school, that age range. And then, oddly enough, now looking back, I realize now that I have a better understanding of money, economics, technology, I better see my inner conflict there. But I realized, you know, this whole filmmaking world's only getting more and more competitive. And I realized, you know, this was years before I was doing Bitcoin, I understood that the movies I want to make are becoming less economically viable, and the jobs that I'm being trained for in film school are not going to exist. And I realized that for me, well, I would say it's very early on. I was even younger than I am now, and I didn't understand Bitcoin. So I think I don't know. I guess I'm more impressed myself, or perhaps conflicted. Like, how do I understand that? But I didn't see Bitcoin. So half impressed, half frustrated. But looking back, that was the right choice. I'm really glad I'm not graduating college with a film degree, going out to LA right now in the middle of these protests, middle of these strikes. And so anyway, so I transitioned from the filmmaking world into real estate world, trying to understand money, understand finance. I first heard of Bitcoin 2017. I thought it was a scam at worst, speculation at best. And so I didn't put in the work of figuring out, is it a scam or speculation? It's just like, either way, that's not my thing. I'm a long-term thinker. I don't want to speculate. And so I ignored Bitcoin in 2017, in retrospect, a crazy person. And 2018 came and went. And then 2019, I had a friend who used to work in the FBI. He was on tour back in 2011, 12, 13, so early days. And so that's how he was introduced to Bitcoin, just by being there. That's all that they used. And so anyway, he had bought quite a bit of Bitcoin back in the early days when the block reward was 50 Bitcoin a block. So he had quite the significant stack. Most people would salivate at. He sold most of it, of course, like most people, but he still had the vast majority of his net worth in it. And so I realized, okay, this guy is smart. I think he's smart. There are things I don't agree with him on, but he has a lot of Bitcoin and he has a very high percentage of it. And I know he understands finance. I know he understands money. You know, he was, you know, so I knew that, okay, in that moment, I'm wrong about something. Either I'm wrong about this person's intelligence, in which case, why am I hanging out with him so much? But why am I seeking advice on other things I was seeking advice from for? Or I'm perhaps incorrect with this Bitcoin thing. Perhaps it's not quite as speculative as I think it is. So that was like 2018. I started watching a bunch of Bitcoin documentaries, 3-4 of them, reading a bunch about it, learning more about it. And I was understanding it quite a bit. And then, of course, 2020 happened, and that changed the world. That changed everything. I realized in 2020, wait a second, we're ticking almost every single major red flag for the market. And I was like, okay, something's wrong here. The bond market no longer makes sense. Everything is becoming more distorted, and perhaps we have crossed the event horizon where we're not going back. And so I was like, okay, I need to learn in hyperdrive. And so really, I put the Bitcoin thing kind of on hold because I was like, okay, this whole bond crisis thing, that's a bigger deal. But then eventually it came circle back, understood by late 2020, like, okay, Bitcoin is a solution to this. And then Bitcoin only by early 2022, so about a year ago. And then January 2023, I posted a thread, just some thoughts about everything I'm saying right now about technology, deflation, deflation in real terms, inflation in nominal terms. Bitcoin plays a role in that. Lots of visuals, lots of charts, lots of metaphors and explanations. And to my complete shock, people were enamored by it. They were thrilled by it. Still, it's amazing. I got more sent to me today. Like, it's quite incredible. Almost every day now I get, well, I have my fair share of haters, but I get lots of compliments, lots of very emotional, heartfelt messages, lots of gifts, invitations like the Canadian Bitcoin Conference, which we were just at, Joey. So really, it's been kind of a whirlwind the last 6 months. I'm working like crazy, and I love it. I wouldn't have it any other way.
So I want to talk a bit about what you're working on, because I think that's a conversation that we could pull the string on quite a few different ways. This movie, this film that you're trying to crowdfund on Geyser, and you've released a number of different shorter kind of clips and discussion pieces about it and tweeted about it. Tell me a bit about this film. I don't know if everyone realizes that this is what's sort of on your plate right now, but to me, you know, I watched a few of your, I honestly don't, Luke, I think people look at the Twitter threads and they don't really understand that it's coming from somewhere and going to somewhere else. And I've been watching a little bit of the stuff on YouTube and reading your threads for the last little while. And I want you to tell people what, you know, really what the project is about.
Yeah. Well, everyone learns at different speeds and in different ways. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think, and this isn't me tooting my own horn, I'm just being upfront. Why do I think that my stuff got so popular so quickly? I mean, people work for years to try to get half the quote unquote following I have. And it for months, and still to a certain degree, I'm like, why are people listening to me? I don't think anything I'm saying is that groundbreaking. But I think one of the things that I've done perhaps quite well is explaining to people and reminding people that this is just technology. Technological paradigms are very hard for our brains to shift. It's the same thing with a locomotive, with a light bulb, with the internet, with the computer, with the written word, with everything else. Every other technological paradigm is very hard for us to adjust to. And so I think in light of that, different brains, different humans adjust to that different worldview in a different way. I think some people really need books, and that's great. There are lots of Bitcoin books. The books about Bitcoin, I just got another one today. That's great. I think lots of people need to just press play, listen to 1,000 hours of podcasts or whatever, and that's great. Fantastic. I think some people need their handheld, perhaps, you know, in person, you know, perhaps especially older folks. But I think perhaps one of the mediums that is the best at communicating a message to a large number of people is a movie. And again, with my filmmaking background, I have my own views of this, but, you know, ultimately we communicate things through stories. And if we tell this technological paradigm shift via the lens of a story, I think that could really resonate with people. I've watched many Bitcoin films and documentaries. Obviously, that's my interest. That's my background. I think many of them are good, but really they fall into two or three different categories. You have the one that's just the smash compilation of news clips as well as interview segments. That's great. That's wonderful. That speaks to people. I think you have this other one where it's kind of put together and it's made to frame kind of like a conspiracy, and it's like this rabbit hole of like, you know, like the classic meme with the guy with the big bulletin board and the red string. He like looks crazy because he's got his coffee. You know, that kind of movie. I think that's the second kind of movie, perhaps. But really, I'm aiming for something different here. You know, people have made Bitcoin films before, but I want to make something that explains from this lens why this thing is significant, why Bitcoin is significant. And I think, and I've said it before, and I'll say it here again, is that I think so much of the problem with explaining it is not accurately. I think so much of the difficulty in explaining this technology is not properly framing the problem. If you frame Bitcoin as an inflation hedge, you end up at incorrect conclusions because, well, Bitcoin's an inflation hedge, sure, but this other thing, this other token, this other yield product is a better inflation hedge because it goes up faster than Bitcoin. Or perhaps gold is also, you know, so you diversify this, that, the other. If you define the problem as inflation and Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation, you'll get some truths, but you also have some horrible misunderstandings that will take more work to undo. And so I think if you frame the problem properly of what Bitcoin actually is solving, and no, Bitcoin's not solving for inflation because it's not solving it, those are all symptoms. If you solve the problem, then all those things become obvious. So the hope with this film is to provide that different vantage point that not necessarily hasn't been done yet, but perhaps has been underdone in comparison to everything else. I think we need more books, we need more podcasts, we need more of everything else. But I think this kind of film is perhaps grossly under-allocated to in the Bitcoin education space. So that's the hope with it. It's going to be a feature film, and it's going to walk people through the story, the timeline of technological paradigms and human progress, what the trade-offs, the pros and cons, different things are, where we are today, what the fundamental problem with energy distribution and money, you know, define the problem, and make it so obvious that Bitcoin becomes the noble solution, and people wonder how on earth they might see it before in a similar way that you and I and many people watching feel. Once you see it, it's hard to realize, like, how did I ever not see this problem before? So anyway, that's the hope. The Bitcoin doesn't need this film. This film is probably not going to be groundbreaking, but you know, the hope is it really we're making it for what I would call dirt cheap too. You know, about $20,000 US or roughly 60 million sats. Compared to other Bitcoin films that are working on right now, it's very cheap. And those films compared to traditional documentaries are being made very cheap. You know, so really this is a bootstraps production, very low cost, very low expense. But the hope is that, assuming I do my part well enough and everyone else is helping me also does their job to the best of their ability, the hope is to orange pill and educate, you know, at least 20,000 people. You know, perhaps we get 1 million views or 100,000 views or whatever. We have, let's say, 20 to 30,000 people at least that better understand this topic or better understand the problem. Well, then hope being that a dollar for every expense and making it equals one new person. So that's the hope, to make something that for us is fulfilling because we're actually contributing to space. And then number two, make something that actually helps adoption and people understand this. Number three, help prevent people from making mistakes that are expensive. And then number four, make something that we feel is a very efficient way of telling the story, where people that donate $10 or $30, $50 worth of sats feel like, hey, I actually helped. And instead of me just trying to bash my head against a wall trying to educate people, I helped make this larger project go through and educate people, you know, in a year or whenever the final product's finished. So I know I covered a lot there. I could keep talking about it all day, I suppose, but that's the general vision.
Well, I think there's some things there that are worth expanding on, Luke. Like, you know, you've got, I think, you know, a particular view on what the problem is. And I like the way you discuss sort of the genesis point for many people. Why Bitcoin is important? Why should I care about this? It's not an inflation hedge. It's something else. It's, you know, this idea that no one understands that energy and maybe particularly monetary energy are at the core of what drives a society. One of the things that we talk about a lot in the Bitcoin space, and I'm sure you will talk about in your film, and maybe we could talk about right now, what is the average person you think missing in terms of the monetary storage? You actually sent out a tweet, I think it was like less than an hour ago, that people spend this time that's like clearly limited that you have on this earth. The worst part is you really don't know how limited it is until it's too late. That's even, you know, a discussion for another time. But, you know, and then they immediately try and save and store the time that they've spent in money that is anything but limited. What do you think it's going to take for the average person to make this jump? I'm sure you've given this some thought, you know, with the understanding that you're making a film trying to reach these folks. What do you think is going to be the aha moment for a lot of people?
I mean, as brutal as it might sound, I think it's impossible. I don't think that's something I had to accept myself. I don't think you can do it. I don't think you can explain to any human of any technological era or paradigm the true significance, the true value, the true meaning, or the true implications of a coming paradigm. This is something I've talked about before, about how, you know, if we were to time travel back to, you know, however many hundred years ago, 300 or 400 years ago, and I would try to explain to somebody a basic incandescent light bulb, like there's no chance. Like the only way they're going to learn, or the only way they're going to understand it fully, is if they spend 500 hours, 1,000 hours longer understanding the light bulb. Because it's like, if your entire worldview is based on wax and whale oil and burning things, it's like the idea of a light bulb makes no sense. Because the tungsten itself makes no sense, because it's so energy intensive to mine and refine and perfect the tungsten. The glass makes no sense because it's so much more difficult than anything they could have done. The electrical socket that you're plugging the light bulb into would have made no sense, because electricity would have made no sense. And the nuclear reactor that the electricity is coming from would have made more sense. Or forget the nuclear reactor. Let's go even simpler. You know, when it comes to the natural gas or the oil, or, you know, whatever you're doing, the coal, you know, even coal at one point made no sense. It would have seemed impossible to people before they were using coal. So it's like, it's, and I think that's what's hard. I think Bitcoiners are trying to, like, what's the silver bullet? What's the one thing that will help people understand it? And I used to try to do that too. But I think perhaps the best answer is just that you can't do it, because you are like, how do I retrain decades worth of a human brain wiring itself one way with one factoid or one paragraph or one? And I just don't think it's possible. And like this film I'm working on too, I don't think it's going to be that either. People are not going to walk away from this film understanding a tenth of the significance of this thing, but they might at least walk away from it like, oh, that is a problem. I've never really realized that's a problem, and I don't really know the solution. But he made a good case of why Bitcoin could be that solution. And it seems like if it is that solution, there's a real direct net gain at increasing the prosperity and quality of living for everyone on Earth and preventing needless human suffering. And so, yeah, so when is that aha moment? I don't know. I think for every person it's different, but I think having one universal aha moment, I think that's impossible. I think it's impossible to change complex human behavior with one simple analogy.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, Luke. One thing I want to touch on, and you know, you released this video that you made the Sunday morning of the conference. And you know, when I remember when I talked to you Sunday morning, you said you had an emotional morning. I wasn't sure what you meant by that. I'm sure now what you meant by that. And so one of the things that, you know, you've kind of taken to heart here in a way I don't think a lot of people have, is the nature of the suffering that comes along with sort of missing on the Bitcoin thing, missing on the monetary energy thing, missing on the time horizon thing, the needless kind of pain that comes with, you know, getting this wrong, I think, for some people and for some societies. There's a, you know, a section of the Bitcoin ecosystem that supports, you know, this thing that I think is kind of growing in popularity, this idea of acceleration theory, where there's, I think, guys.
Oh boy, we're going there.
I think it's relevant to what you're saying. And even if, you know, I don't know if I agree with it or not, I understand the point of view of these guys. But one part of me says that we maybe should like try and preserve as much of, or try and prevent as much pain as we can, while the other side of me says maybe the silver bullet I'm looking for, instead of thinking about trying to explain to people why monetary energy is important, maybe the silver bullet is forcing pain on all these people to whatever threshold it takes for them to get it through pushing policy or politicians or whatever that just are going to have this outcome no matter how painful it is. And so do you have a view on whether or not, you know, there's a way to phrase this question that, you know, is not quite coming to me here, but I'll do my best. is there a way to...
The question is always harder than the answer, isn't it?
Isn't that the case, right? So this is the thing, right? There's a balance here between making sure people get it and making sure people don't, you know, die, quote unquote, in the process of trying to get it because of all the terrible things that are happening. Do you have a view on that? I'm sure that you do, and I would love to hear you push back on the acceleration theory crowd, because it seems to me like the more I go on Twitter, the more I see acceleration theory taking hold.
Yeah. One of the nights at the Canadian Bitcoin conference, I was at the bar. Yeah, there were a whole bunch of us. And of course, there's this one table, you know, people hanging out, having a conversation. And then there's the accelerationist table where that was just...
It's just a conversation.
That was its own corner.
Yes.
That was quite the table. I've given this answer before. The people that are the accelerationists don't particularly like my answer. And the people that are not accelerationists kind of don't understand my answer. And then, of course, the people aren't Bitcoin entirely. That just goes over the head. But I guess the same by larger worldview. And then... answer your question, but sure. my larger worldview is that life is energy, and if we stop energy, then life ceases to exist. I think it's true for all forms of life, and it's not a matter of me thinking that. That's just objective. And so if our society is redistributing, destroying, and manipulating energy, well, then we're doing the same thing with life. And that was the point I made. That's the point I made continually in my presentation at the Canadian Bitcoin conference. Like Joey said, it was recorded. Thankfully, it was on my YouTube channel. If you weren't able to afford to go, so you know, you could at least watch my presentation there. People have said they really liked it, so if you want to check it out, I'm going to do the surface level explanation here, but that I really dive into there. But basic idea being that people fear central bank digital currencies and CBDCs because they think that, oh, once we cross that line, then we'll never come back. We'll have all this pain, destruction, despair once we're in the CBDC world. And the point I make with my presentation, the point I made before, is that we're already there. We're already at that case today. You know, there's 23, 24 million people in North Korea. I mean, they already have a full-on totalitarian CBDC state, essentially. What do we fear with the CBDC? We fear surveillance. We fear no property rights. We fear no freedom to move, no freedom to travel, no ability to protest. We're censored. You know, we fear all these things and half a dozen other negative consequences of CBDCs. It's like, but the 20 million people in North Korea, it's like, that's not some thing they have to fear about the future. That's what it is now. You know, you have hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East that are under various, whether governments or terrorist states, or, you know, obviously it's very complicated, but you have hundreds of millions of people there that are on direct rule, similar to that. In China, you have a million people, the Uyghurs, in camps, you know, but not quite to the same degree as the camps of the Holocaust, but still, they're not moral, they're evil, and they're there today. They already have that fear manifested for them. And then I think it's roughly 4.6, 4.7 million people a year or so that freeze from a lack of cheap energy. So I think that, and that perhaps is one of the most under thought about areas of needless suffering. We are currently in a monetary standard that is artificially forcing prices up. We artificially force house prices, car prices, gold prices, stock prices. We force these things up artificially to prevent a credit unwind, because nobody wants to face a credit unwind. Yeah, it feels like 2008 on steroids. And so we do everything we possibly can to avoid that. And everything has a trade-off. And since fiat is a lie, since fiat is made up out of thin air, there is no such thing as a free lunch, and we have to pay for it somehow. And so when we have our base layer monetary system as a lie, our cost is the barrel of a gun to enforce the lie, because it's not truth in of itself. We have to use force. We have to use violence. We have to use aggression to defend that lie, to force it onto other people. And a lack of cheap energy is one of those negative externalities, that by us artificially inflating the cost of energy up, we are directly contributing to those 4.6 million people a year that don't have enough heat to survive. And then you have other things, you like drought, famine. This is one of the things to talk about in the presentation, that while Ukraine and NATO and Russia, while that conflict is of major significance, both historically and in terms of amount of life lost, or the amount of life lost is probably much higher than what we're being told. But when you include for famine, there are many wars that have higher cumulative death tolls than the Ukraine-Russia conflict going on right now. Yeah, and we just don't forget about that. And so my point in all this is being that every single year, there are easily tens of millions of premature, needless deaths as a direct result of our global society of 8 billion people believing this monetary distortion that we can print energy out of thin air, essentially, and that we can have ourselves be like these de facto gods, that if we just manipulate money just right, we can have everything smooth sailing. And it's not just the amount of death that's happening, it's the amount of prevented prosperity. So let's take nuclear energy as one example. This is one of the cool things about the Canadian Bitcoin Conference. It was a discussion with Canadian Parliament member and a nuclear, I forget his title, you know, something super smart and sciencey. But, you know, nuclear energy, that's a major talking point. And the ironic thing, all these green people with all these environmentalists, is that they are pounding the table on, oh, climate change, blah, blah, blah. But they're actively fighting against the solutions to that. Now, I would argue that's because if you continue the problem, you can get reelected into office easier. But but politics aside, you know, we are actively delaying the transition to nuclear energy. We're actively delaying the transition out of fuels that are inherently unsustainable, you know, and that's a whole another can of worms there. But the pollutants from those fossil fuels, the pollutants from these chemicals are roughly 5 to 6 million deaths a year just from air pollution. I've asked myself, you know, that's probably as a result of our use of fossil fuels. And that is a trade-off. And that's one of the things that needs to be emphasized, that these things all have trade-offs. If we're upgrading, you know, fossil fuels are the moral thing to do in light of a world that only has wood to burn. Like, right, that's the only thing that makes sense. But now we have superior forms of energy to that have lower trade-offs. We have things that are much more reliable, or just as reliable, let's say, with much fewer negative externalities. And so we're not just causing death by being inefficient today and artificially forcing prices up today, in addition to forcing housing being more and more expensive for my generation, in addition to defunding retirees and destroying people's 401ks, you know, all those other things that don't even have death directly tied to it. We have all these inefficiencies of today that's causing pain today. And then also we have the pain of tomorrow that is going to come unless we start moving away from that path immediately today. And we are moving away from that path. And so coming back to the accelerationist theory, then, if, yeah, I know, sorry, long answer, but, and this is going to be touched on in the movie as well, is that, you know, this isn't just some arbitrary thing like, oh, we want number to go up and blah, 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 Bitcoin, whatever. It's like, it's the only thing that can happen if we're going to be an optimist and assume that this is the path. You know, if today, conservatively, of these, say, 30, 40, 50 million preventable deaths a year, a third of them, a fifth of them, however many of them, are completely preventable just by changing monetary standards. You know, it's like 10 million people a year. That's 30,000 a day or so, 1,000 people an hour. And so that's the accelerationist theory, that we should accelerate to Bitcoin immediately, get it over with, stop the bleeding of 1,000 people an hour, and just transition to where we don't have that. That makes sense to me. But my one caveat with that is that that's assuming humans are logical, and humans are not logical. And as horrible as 10 million preventable deaths a year is, there is always a probability that it ends in conflict. And I do think that's the path we're heading on. Not to get too doom and gloom, but I mean, why does every global conflict happen? World War II, World War I, the French Revolution, the Seven Years' War, the 30 Years' War, on and on and on, back and back. Revolutionary War, you know, here in America. All these things are a result of resource misdistribution or resource misallocation. And right now we have the largest misallocation of global resources in history, and that's getting worse. And the longer fiat survives, it'll get worse. And so I want to transition to Bitcoin as fast as possible. And so I agree with the acceleration at that point, with the caveat that we can avoid that war. And that's something I don't know to. Perhaps the right answer is we extend it as long as possible. So as people make the transition, they understand at a more reasonable pace, and they don't actively go to their politicians and demand them to press the nuclear button. You know, if Bitcoin adoption is so fast that people, if Bitcoin adoption is so accelerated and so quick that people don't go the orange route and instead they run to their politicians and they demand they go to war, I mean, to me, that's not a good outcome. My goal is prevent the pain of the transition as much as possible. And I think that would be extremely painful because that would dwarf the annual, having a massive loss of life like that would dwarf the annual bleeding. And so I'm not saying I support one over the other. I'm not saying I know what the solution is, because it's like we could have war in one scenario or the other scenario. It's like there are so many externalities. It's like I have no idea. But that's why I don't have a hard line of agree or disagree. It's like, yeah, I want it as quick as possible. And ultimately, more important to me than the speed of how quick it happens is how much preventable suffering will there be in that process. And so whether that happens overnight, like literally tonight, Jerome Powell comes up tomorrow and says, hey, we printed an infinite amount of cash for Bitcoin, it's all over, which perhaps that happens, or perhaps it takes 100 years. I think neither of those will happen. But anyway, that was a very long answer, but that's just to say, that's what my priority is. And if accelerationists are right, then good. But I don't think it's 100% certain that that theory is right.
It's funny. There's a couple of guys from that table in the chat I can see here. How long did you sit at that table for on Saturday night? I was at that table for a bit. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah. No. And they're right. You know, it's like I have nothing against it at all. I mean, it's just, I don't know. To a certain extent, again, it's like we're trying to envision so many global problems and then like speculate other numbers. It's like, I don't know. I have no idea, but I do know my large two concerns are World War III, number one, or number two, some climate change virtue signaling where we cut off the growing populations of the developing world from cheap energy. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, it's like, to me, those two things, it's like those two things dwarf all the other concerns. And one of those, I think, is more probable if we if we have the quote-unquote accelerationist theory. I think the other one is more probable if we delay it out. And so, I don't know. But, you know, ultimately, my long point at the end of my spiel is like, I have no idea. But at the end of the day, we're all accelerating, whether we are quote-unquote accelerationists or not. I'm accelerating on this podcast right now by educating more, the film I'm working on, by educating people. That's accelerating. So it's like, and that's the funny thing with this thing, is that the faster we allocate to it, the faster we make it happen, the faster we accelerate. So at the end of the day, my opinion on it doesn't even matter, because number one, I have no idea. And number two, I'm accelerating either way. So what's the point?
Yeah, it's funny. There's no good answer, right? It's a fun question to think about. And there's some difficult kind of back and forth. Now, Luke, I told you I'd keep you 40 minutes. It's late. But there's a question. I want to ask.
Well, that's my fault for going over.
That's okay. I don't mind. Those are good answers, man. I'm happy to let the guests roll downhill. We love that here on the CBP. This question I wanted to ask you, because you're a religious fellow. You have, you know, Jesus Saves Your Soul in your Twitter bio, and you know, the thing I often wonder. I should preface this. I was raised Catholic. I'm not particularly religious now. I don't practice. You know, I'm what they call a C&E Catholic, Christmas and Easter, and I don't even do that anymore, to be honest with you. And
I know. Yep.
You know, like that's how things have gone for me and a lot of my friends. And one of the things I'm curious about when it comes to the mix of religion and Bitcoin, especially for a guy like you, right? Your presentation at the conference was great. Some of the stuff you tweet, you know, is in this vein as well. This idea that Bitcoin is a sort of indisputable truth. There's something about Bitcoin that is true and provable and important and beyond dispute. And religion is, I think, for a lot of people, anything but indisputable, provable, and, you know, important in day-to-day life. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you could, do you have like a way that you square those two things as a guy who's, you know, sort of a believer and a guy who values the absolute truth, you know, provable nature of Bitcoin? How do those two things mesh for you? I'm curious.
I mean, I don't think they have to mesh, at least for me. I think everyone has a worldview of truth, and what they view is true. I think for many people, they have a religious view of truth where they think there's either supernatural or deity or divine kind of form of truth, something that's beyond, let's say, the universe. I think there are other people that perhaps don't believe in a God, quote unquote, but they believe in the scientific method, and they believe in the laws of physics and this and that and the other. And so that's one of the reasons why I don't mind talking about my views, because my worldview is that everyone has a worldview, whether they say it or not. And so for me, I don't feel there's a need to square those things. Like, I don't take my, like, I don't view my faith as being untrue, and I view Bitcoin as truth, and I have to square these two things. To me, it's like, to me, they're both true, and they both can be true, and they're not mutually exclusive. So for me, I don't have to square that. I know there are people, and I, this is one thing to get a lot of hate for on Twitter, but, you know, people will say that, oh, Jesus never existed, or he never said these things, this, that, the other, and I've, and perhaps I shouldn't have given up. I've kind of given up at this point, because it's just the historical evidence is so clear that, you know, it's like you can disagree about what he, what, who he was or whatever, but he existed. he existed. We know he existed, and we know essentially what he said, and we know he was killed for it. And there are many things we don't know for sure, but it's actually surprising. I went to Israel last year, and I went thinking that I knew a lot, and I was schooled quickly how little I knew and how much. And anyway, I won't go into that rabbit hole. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's I talk about it online because not everyone has to know my religious views to understand my views in Bitcoin. And likewise, people don't have to know my age. They don't have to know my experience. They don't have to know my filmmaking background. But it's like, I'd rather just say all those things so people know where I'm coming from. And they know, because, like, I want Bitcoin adoption to happen. And I feel that people will better be open to my Bitcoin views and better be open to hearing me out if they don't have to guess what my background is. Like, oh, I wonder what his, you know, I wonder what his education is. I wonder what his worldview is. You know, if I'm just upfront, like, this is who I am. This is what I believe. This is my worldview. This is my age. This is my experience. And these are the things I really believe. Then that, number one, holds me more accountable of being consistent with my beliefs. And then number two, I think helps people better see that transparency of who I am, what I believe. And I think that's both good for the Bitcoin arguments I make, but also then the Christian arguments I make.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Luke. It's important to be open and honest to people when you come into the space. Bitcoin, and especially Bitcoin Twitter, has a way of, you know, finding out things anyways. And it's important, like you mentioned, if we're truly looking for global adoption, there's going to be a lot of people who are your age, a lot of people who are my age, a lot of people with your background, my worldview, your worldview, who are looking for a common thread, something that they have, you know, with people who they don't know, but everyone knows maybe something is wrong, something is amiss in their financial life, their day-to-day life, their family life, all these things. And there's answers for everybody that I think are commonly held. Now, last question for you then in this vein, what do you think, you know, a new entrant to the Bitcoin space, you know, let's say you're just finding your footing, you've started a Twitter account, you know, what can these people do? How can they contribute? It's an intimidating, is it intimidating or what? Like, you're fairly new, right? You kind of jumped in 2 feet. So what do they do?
Can someone else answer that? And I hear their answer. I don't know. I get that question so much all the time. It's like, Luke, how do I grow my YouTube channel? How do I grow my Twitter following? Or how do I do blah, blah, blah,
not
blah,
even
blah.
That. Growing the following is one thing, but like, people want to just contribute to the conversation.
Well, what do I do?
It's so hard. Yeah. What advice do you have for these guys?
Just do your best. I really don't know. I mean, like I said, it was a complete shock when my thing went viral back in January, because I was like, well, I posted on YouTube, nobody cared. And I posted on other social medias and nobody cared. I'd given in-person presentations to small groups of people and to larger groups of people. Very few people cared. And so it was a complete shock when it went viral. So, I mean, perhaps persistence, because my message didn't change. You know, that's one of the things I think about. It's like, wow, I was saying everything I'm saying now, I was saying for years before I posted on Twitter. It's like, wow, I wonder how many more people I could have impacted if that following had been there early. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It's all under the bridge, but it's interesting that nothing changed and it just happened, you know. And so perhaps persistence is the best answer. Persistence and intelligence is simply error correction. And the beautiful thing with being on social media and having all the instant engagement, if you know how to use it, is that it's instant error correction. you know, like I can tweet something in a matter of 5 minutes. Yeah, really, I'm not into the algorithms. I don't care. I don't track my metrics nearly as much as some people think I do. I just don't have the time. I need to hire somebody to do that for me. But you know, but if I so desired, you could post something, and within a few minutes, you don't even have to look at your metrics. It's just within the first few minutes or the first couple of days, you know immediately, like, did this click, did this not? Mm-hmm. And you know, perhaps it takes longer. Like the stuff I post on YouTube sat there for months until my stuff on Twitter went viral, and people, like, I literally never, this is not exactly what your question was, but I find it fascinating. So I posted these videos, you know, hours of content on YouTube, you know, less than 10 views for months. Then I post on Twitter, that goes viral. And then people started searching my name on YouTube, looking for if I was on there. I did not make one cross-reference to my YouTube for like 3 months or something like that. And people were actually asking me to start making that's really when I knew that, like, okay, maybe I have something here. When people were taking the time not just to click on my stuff on Twitter, but Google my name on a different platform, YouTube, and actually watching that. And simultaneously, so anyway, I don't really know. But then that kind of goes against the persistence argument, because the YouTube thing, I was persistent.
Well, you know, let me help you. There's a guy in the chat, Boomer, who's in the chat all the time, and he says that the Blockware podcast you did when you had 1,000 Twitter followers was great. And you know, that kind of thing is important, right? The message. And I know this from doing this show. You know, when we started this show a couple of years ago, I think we were getting like a couple hundred plays an episode, and it was like a, you know, a passion project, right? And to be honest with you, Luke, much like you, it sounds like on your end, it still is. And everything else and the opportunities and the fun that's come with it, you know, it's gravy. But to your point, the message hasn't changed for a lot of us. And I think that maybe what we're seeing not only is just this persistence and consistency, it's also that more and more people are realizing they need help that's not being offered to them in the traditional, you know, finance space, traditional means, right? It is good to see, regardless of how you spin it. Okay, now we ask all our guests, if you're a first-time guest, and so as always, we have to ask you about your foot speed. So I know that you were at the conference and you were probably next to or talked to Stefan Levera at least once or twice. And so Stefan Levera, shorter fellow, but he's pretty lean. And Stefan Levera, shorter fellow, but I think he's pretty lean. And I bet you he runs a pretty quick 40-yard dash. Do you think you could beat Stefan Levera in a 40-yard dash or no?
I have no idea.
Well, what do you think? You got to say yes or no. I'm going to clip this and put it online. So you really have no choice but to answer the question now.
Who is this again?
Stefan Levera.
I don't know. I've not seen him run.
Yeah, but I mean, every guy, this is like our nature, Luke. You know, you see another guy, you think like you size him up. That's what we do. Everyone does
it. Okay,
this.
Sure. I'll beat him. Why not? It's probably above 50% that I'll beat him.
Okay, good. I like it.
I'm probably faster than I'm probably faster than at least half the population, so it's probably good odds of beating him too. There you go.
Good number. Okay, Luke, tell people where they can find you, Twitter, YouTube, and we'll take you offline here.
Yeah. People can find me on Twitter, YouTube under my name, Luke Broyles, B-R-O-Y-L-E-S. If they really enjoy my work, both whether this podcast or just in general, really mean the world to me if you help make this film possible. We've got no corporate sponsors or nothing like that. It's really like a pleb-driven movement. Actually, it's that you didn't ask this, but this is something that's meant a lot to me. That I think this is week 6 on Geyser fundraising, and this movie I'm working on is still the top trending Bitcoin film in the entire world on Geyser, both in terms of number of sats given, so amount of money given, as well as the number of people they're supporting. And so that means a lot to me. That tells me that people are enjoying my content, people are supporting it, and they want to see more, and they want to see this vision come true. So anyway, if you're willing to help, it means the world to me. Like I said earlier, the goal is for every dollar that's donated, roughly every 3,500 sats, to be one orange pill, let's say. So hopefully it's one more person that doesn't get rug pulled in the scams and yield farming of the next cycle. So if you want to, let's say, invest in Bitcoin adoption, it would mean the world to me, help my vision come true, hopefully help other people in the process, and you know, maybe accelerate if that's your mantra. So, but ultimately we're all accelerating either way, whether we identify as one or not. So YouTube, Twitter, or Geyser, would be my recommendation for people, those three places. So
killer. Yeah, we'll throw we're going to throw the Geyser webpage in the show notes. If you want to donate to Luke, any denomination is fine. I think we should all be pushing for more content like this. It's rare that a guy like Luke steps onto the scene, makes a splash, and then instead of, you know, trying to monetize the clicks, decides he's going to make a film, crowdsource, and try and orange pill people. That's a noble endeavor, sir. So we appreciate it.
Yeah. The goal is to break even. That's the goal. So yeah, we'll see if we do, but I think so. It's the momentum's been good and very appreciative to folks. So yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Thanks everybody. Thanks Luke. And we'll take you offline. We'll see you next time. Everyone. Good job, buddy.